making sure your family is prepared for a major emergency. If something happened, a natural disaster or a cyber attack, and all the ATM machines were down, your smartphone wasn't working, and your grocery store couldn't stock its shelves, what would you do? Is your family prepared for a scenario like that? According to a 2015 FEMA survey, 60% of Americans have not practiced what to do in a disaster in the past year, and only 39% have developed an emergency plan and discussed it with their family. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss basic emergency preparedness for a modern world with multiple threats, from weather-related disasters to cyber attacks. We'll talk with local emergency experts, as well as journalist Ted Koppel, the author of the new book, Lights Out. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What would you do if your power went out? Not for a few minutes or a few hours, but for a few days or weeks. What if you were at work and your kids were at school and your spouse was away when this happened? Do you have a plan to communicate when communication will be difficult? Well, today we're going to talk about things like this, personal emergency planning. We are not here to scare you, but we're going to make sure that you think about planning for possible disasters. With me in the studio, John Lamb, who is with the American Red Cross, and Josh Francis, the Director of Emergency Management at Maine Medical Center. And at 12:30, we'll be joined by Ted Koppel. Thank you for being here today. And of course, we want to hear from you. How prepared do you feel in case of a natural disaster or terrorist attack? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Josh, former generations, I think, had more of a culture of preparedness than we do now. I think we're a lot of us, and I'm speaking for myself here, are pretty complacent. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about what we can learn from the greatest generation as far as emergency preparedness.
I think we can definitely learn a lot of things. And when we talk about personal preparedness, which is the nation's number one strategy to prepare for a disaster, and you look back at all of the lists and guides and recommendations, they are things that we were touting in the civil defense days that were really important to do then, and for some reason it's been this gap, and that we're really trying to bring that back. But it's very, very similar to what we were doing in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
But I remember growing up, for example, my parents would never let the gas tank go below a half in case they had to evacuate. But I, and probably just about everybody I know, sometimes let the gas tank now get down to fumes before filling it up. I mean, this is just one example that pops into my mind of things we don't do now that maybe we need to be thinking about.
And we do things like wait till we take our last prescription pill before we call the pharmacy to get a refill. And, when we talk about personal preparedness, it's always, hey, make sure to stay on top of those things so that when the pharmacy is closed because of a snowstorm or tornado, or they can't receive their shipments during a major disaster or major incident, that you're not stuck without your medication, and therefore you're not needing to seek medical attention and take resources away from people who really do need it in times of disaster.
Interesting. John, what are some of the basic things that the American Red Cross recommends? Is it still water, batteries for the flashlight, a radio?
What you really want to do is ask yourself, what type of disaster or emergency could affect our area or us personally? Home fires, by far the most common in Maine. In a situation like that, you need to be prepared to leave your house quickly. We recommend creating or making what's called a go bag. It's a bag you keep next to the door that you grab on your way out. It contains things like list of medications that you need, contact information for your healthcare providers, contact information for families. I keep a little cash in mind just in case I need something. Extra clothing, depending upon where you live. We live in a cold climate. If you're in a rural area, it may take a little bit of time for a first responder to reach you. So I'd be thinking about that. Thinking back to last winter, we had that nasty snowstorm that dropped 2 feet of snow on us, and a lot of people hunkered in. So you want a kit in case you are stuck inside your home. Things like non-perishable foods, You know, if you like tuna fish, those pouches are terrific. You don't need a can opener, and you don't need to warm them up or anything. Extra batteries, flashlights, a radio, a crank radio is terrific. And, you know, water, again, 1 gallon per person per day.
1 gallon per person per day. And I've heard to plan for 2 weeks. Is that what the Red Cross recommends?
Yeah, I think, I think in terms of a scenario, what's the worst thing that could happen? I know a lot of people, and Josh knows this, I think, better than I, that you really want a lot of water.
And both of you, and the American Red Cross has resources on its website, correct, about ideas about whether you need to hunker down or evacuate, ways to be ready or more ready than you may be now. Josh, what have we learned from Katrina and Sandy in terms of personal emergency preparedness?
Oh, we've learned a lot. I mean, there's a lot of data that has come out of that FEMA has published out of those events, which is really good for us in the planning world. The planning world and the data tells us that not a lot of people prepare and have food and water and extra supplies, but the data also shows us that a lot of people are going to ask us for help when disaster strikes. We saw that during Hurricane Katrina, Rita, Wilma, which were huge in the Gulf Coast, and we even saw that fast forwarding, 7, 8, 9 years to Hurricane Sandy, when the exact same thing happened.
That despite the lessons that we maybe should have learned from previous natural disasters, for some reason, people don't do these basic things. John, you're nodding. Is it human nature to just put these things off?
I think it's a lot of things. People, think it can't happen to them. They figure they'll deal with it when it happens. Mm. If you go to a supermarket the day before a blizzard, there's a line of people buying food and water and things like that. Whereas, buying it in advance, a little by little, is going to make things a lot easier.
How is, we started the program by talking about what former generations did. Though the threats are different now. We aren't talking, thank goodness, most of the time about planning for a nuclear attack, but there's the real possibility, and we're going to have Ted Koppel on the show later, of a cyber attack that could take down the power grid. There's the real, as we've unfortunately seen this past week, the real possibility of a terrorist attack. How is preparedness now different than it used to be as far as what we do for our own families?
Well, I'll take the first part of that. I think that the public is now more aware since global information flows so quickly now. People are more aware of all of the different potential disasters that can happen. We used to focus just on natural disasters. And so the public's really aware of all the different possibilities out there. But I will bring it back to the most basics, whether you have an evacuation order because of a terrorist incident like a lot of the community did both in Boston during the Marathon bombings and did in Paris, or you have a shelter-in-place order like both of those places had as well, or you're hunkered down for 2 or 3 weeks because like an ice storm of 1998 here in Maine scenario, you're still leveraging the exact same resources and personal preparedness supplies that you would for any of those disasters. That's why it's really simple when we talk about putting those supplies together. They're really an all-hazards approach to staying well and being prepared for any of these type events.
And John, it's just common sense, but it really depends where you live, what you need to be thinking the most about.
Absolutely. I use my house as an example. I live in Saco right in town. So if I were to have a fire, I'm probably 3 minutes from the police station, so I could get over there regardless of the circumstances and pretty much regardless of what I'm wearing. My last house was a little bit outside of town, so it would take a lot longer for disaster responders to reach me. My go bag had a packable down jacket. It had winter socks, winter hat, gloves. So really, there are basic things that everybody should do in terms of the food and the water, but also be thinking about what are your odds of losing power. And if you're going to lose power, you have to be prepared either with a backup source or a generator. So kind of look at your individual situation. And it's a good time for a family to have a discussion. Brainstorm ideas. What would we need if we lose power? What would we want if we left the house? And how would we reach each other? And then you develop a plan and then you practice it.
All right. Why don't I ask you, Josh, I know we're talking about personal emergency preparedness here, but I'm curious with Your job as Director of Emergency Preparedness for Maine Medical Center, the largest medical facility in the state, in the region, what do you think about day-to-day? What are you trying to guard against? Obviously, incredibly important to keep Maine Medical Center open no matter what happens. What's on your radar? What keeps you up at night?
Well, a lot keeps me up at night. There's so many different, managing disasters and potential disasters, so complex. They're never the same, even though you think about putting a lot of time into actually assessing all your hazards and looking at your vulnerabilities. But at the end of the day, our goal is to keep the lights on and the water running to be able to provide care to patients in need. So I tie that back to personal preparedness. It's something that we tout throughout the medical center with our employees and try to give them tools and resources so that during disasters, we know that they're going to come to work, that they're going to be prepared and not worried about their families at home, that they will be able to be there to provide care to people who really need it, both the patients who may be impacted by the disaster or who were there during the disaster needing routine medical care. Because no matter how many feet of snow we get, whether there's a terrorist attack, whether there's a flood or fire, we need to be there. Hospitals are known as one of the safe havens, just like a fire station. People flock there. We saw it in 1998 during the big ice storm. We were the one place with the lights on, the water running, where you could get a hot meal. Families convened there, and people came for emergency care.
So I'm guessing Maine Medical Center, multiple backup generators, stockpiled food for the cafeteria. What else are things that we may not even have thought of that you all are doing?
Well, we do, the education piece is huge, letting folks know about personal preparedness from the employees, like I mentioned. But, you know, we spend a lot of time on backup fuel, different types of fuel, so that we can keep lights on, water running, the heat going, the sterilizers going. We need to do everything that we can to stay in business. We have arrangements with emergency water suppliers so that if we did lose water from our two main feeds coming to Portland from Sebago Lake, that we have these agreements for bottled water and water for things like our steam plant.
John?
And having worked at Maine Med with Josh on his emergency preparedness team, you can really see the difference when something happened, how well prepared the organization was. So if we had a major flood or, he mentioned the storms, that organization was very well prepared. So we certainly would encourage other organizations to do that.
And Josh, you kind of alluded to this before, but you believe it's a matter of citizenship and personal responsibility to be prepared, correct? It's more than just doing what's good for your family, but there's some pretty high stakes if you as an individual are not prepared.
I truly believe that. I mean, I think we all have a duty to have some level of personal preparedness, because if you think about it from the responder side, from the emergency management and incident command, when folks aren't prepared, they're utilizing resources, asking for help during disasters, which potentially takes away those resources for people who really do need it. So instead of the ambulances and fire departments going to homes or checking on people who really need to be checked on, they maybe have calls for help for people who could have, prepared in advance with really simple things and therefore not needed the resources. And we all know during disasters, the resources are really, really scarce.
I'm going to go to the calls now, and we're going to start in Woodland with Gail. Hi, Gail. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I live in Woodland in Aroostook County, and when we have storms or the power goes out or if we have a need to call 911, we really depend on our landline telephones. Cell phones are just not dependable here. Now, I've heard that in some states, telephone companies are opting out of their responsibility to provide landline service. This is a really frightening possibility for many elderly folks in our rural areas. So my question is, while we know that cell phone technology is improving every year, can you talk about the importance of telephone landlines in rural communities like mine when it comes to emergency preparedness?
Well, I think that that landlines do play a really important role in what we do. They're tied into our public safety answering points, our PSAPs, which do the reverse 911, so they know where people are calling from. I think that you'll find that landlines are not going to go away. I think people are really moving towards cell phones as primary ways of communications, but I don't think that landlines are going to go away. I think they're relied that technology is relied on for a lot more than people realize. One of my suggestions is to reach out to the county or your local emergency management official. Every single town in Maine has a local emergency manager who's identified. It's really it's an important, that could be the fire chief or the police chief or the town manager. But I also encourage you to reach out to the county emergency management. Each 16 counties have emergency management directors who could really help you work, sort of identify and work through some of these questions.
I'll ask both of you all a personal question. Do you still have your landline at home, or do you go cell phone only?
I still have landline.
Not only do I have a landline, but I also have a non-cordless phone that we can plug in because, you know, many people realize that they're relying on that charged battery on the cordless phone. So you need an old-fashioned telephone to be able to plug in to have it work.
All right, Gail, thank you so much for your call. We're going to need to go to a break, and then we'll get to some more viewer comments and questions. We're talking about emergency preparedness. This is Maine Calling.
Maine Calling possible, as do MEMIC, a workers' compensation insurance company dedicated to safer workplaces, fair treatment for all workers, and a strong Maine economy. On the web at MEMIC.com. And Sweetser, helping children, adults, and families address mental health and substance abuse issues since 1828. Learn more at sweetser.org.
In Tennessee, pregnant women who use drugs can be charged with a crime called fetal assault, so some women are skipping prenatal care.
I didn't want to go to the hospital. I worry about that a lot now. I wonder how many babies they're not known about because the mothers are afraid to get help.
More later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered gets underway this afternoon at 4 o'clock. We've often heard, so many channels, not much to watch, when viewers describe why they choose MPBN television. And there is good news for folks who appreciate the quality programming public television has to offer. MPBN has not just one channel, we have three. Our MPBN World channel explores our world through programs like the NewsHour, Nova, and many others. The Create channel includes many of the best-known cooking, carpentry, travel, gardening, painting, and craft programs. Both World and Create are available over the air and on many of Maine's cable company's digital tiers. For more information, including how to find the channels over the air or on cable, see your experience member guide or visit mpbn.net and click on television. You can also call us. Just ask for audience services.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what to do if disaster strikes. In the studio with me, John Lamb is with the American Red Cross, and Josh Francis is Director of Emergency Management at Maine Medical Center. We are being joined now by Lynette Miller. Lynette is with the Maine Emergency Management Agency. Lynette, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Lynette, I wanted to ask you, what kinds of emergencies does MEMA plan for?
Well, Josh made a reference earlier to all hazards, and that really is it. It is any natural hazard you can think of that would affect the state, and we look at, you know, historical facts and our vulnerability at that. Look at technological hazards such as hazardous materials and things of that nature. But also, unfortunately, in this day and age, what we call human-caused hazards. Those kinds of things that could be perpetrated deliberately by someone.
What does MEMA hope that individual citizens will do to prepare when an emergency strikes?
Well, you know, I think both Josh and John really covered the basics. In the ideal world, everyone who can take care of themselves and their families does, and that frees up emergency responders to take care of everyone else. But we know, realistically, from data that's been collected over many, many years, that disasters are just something that people don't like to think about. And a lot of people are not, you know, up to that gold standard of preparedness. But the missing piece of that and what I count really as a good outcome is when we do know that something is coming and we do have information out about, you know, the storm that's coming or a risk that exists. And people do pay attention, and, you know, they may not have everything in their homes that they may need, But if they have good information, they'll listen to it and they'll take action that's appropriate. And failing the gold standard of everyone having the water and the kits and everything else, that's what we hope for, that everyone stays informed in a dangerous situation, listens to emergency instructions, and follows those. And really in Maine, that's been our experience. People do that. They do comply when they're asked to take action.
Lynette, Ted Koppel will be joining us on the program in just a few minutes. He believes our country and our communities are not prepared for a cyber attack that would take down infrastructure such as the power grid. Do you agree?
It's certainly an emerging threat, and some would say emerged. It's definitely from incidents that we've seen something that's out there, and it's something that we know our utilities here are planning for actively. Certainly the state government as a whole has a very active cybersecurity planning process going on to identify vulnerabilities and make sure that those are plugged, essentially. But it's certainly a hazard that has come as a companion to the technology that we love and has made our lives easier in many ways. But with that comes that risk that it does need to be taken seriously.
Lynette Miller, thanks so much for joining us. Lynette Miller is with the Maine Emergency Management Agency. We're going to go now to Brad calling from Old Orchard Beach. Hi, Brad. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great.
So what we do for preparedness, I also want to throw in, it's not just about the physical things that you have inside your house, but what you're prepared for, such as like reading up on the internet. There's so many instructables on emergency preparedness. Even things like your phone line still carries a basic voltage. And with a simple resistor, you can plug in basic small lights and things like that for times when you don't have power.
Huh. Do you have any to recommend specifically, Brad?
Like I said, there's some great, like if you go on Instructables, just search it on Google or whatever, there's some great ones like that. There's simple resistors you can plug in. You can have it all made out for just in case there isn't a disaster where you lose power. That way there's always, you know, at least some source of power in the house.
All right.
For a short period of time.
Well, thanks for calling. We have two questions now about water. Diana in South Portland writes, what is the best way to store water? We tried plastic bottles, but they degrade and leak. Does water, quote, go bad? Another caller from Rockland wanted to know the thoughts on purifying water. What do you all recommend?
I rotate my water through. So I buy bottles and then over time, I'll check the date, the expiration date, and then just use the
So water that does expire. Do you buy it in plastic gallon jugs, John?
Yeah, and I found some of the water tastes better than others. Mm-hmm. But again, if it's an emergency, I think water is going to be good.
And what do you guys do at Maine Medical Center?
Well, to go back to the question real quick, I just want to encourage people to buy water that's been sealed in a plant or under the sort of a sterile environment, right? So rather than filling jugs out of the tap and putting a screw on, you're going to get some really gross, nasty stuff growing in there, and it will taste bad very, very quickly. If you are buying gallon jugs off the shelf that have been really sealed up, like by Poland Springs or some other commercial supplier, it's going to last a lot longer. So I don't know if there's a true recommendation or expiration date on water, but surely it's good to look at it and inspect it. And just what John, I do the same thing. We rotate our water through, and we do it at the hospital too. Our backup stock for our patients and visitors, we rotate through. Once we use it, we bring in new stuff and rotate it out.
We have a colleague who told me that he freezes his water. He has got an extra freezer, and he's got a bunch of jugs of water in there. Is that something you'd recommend?
It's a very smart idea. One, takes up your freezer space, and your freezer uses less energy, and then things stay colder for longer if you're without power, and you can use it for backup.
All right. We have a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wants to know if solar electric is a reasonable alternative to the power going down. Do either of you feel qualified to answer that question? Not really. That'll be a question for another day. John?
Yeah, I've looked into it for my house, but I'm still in just the early stages of researching it.
Okay. We have an email from Sandy. She writes, please discuss how homeowners with drilled wells can have water when there is no power for a pump. Is there a way to put a hand pump on a deep well? Does the water line have to be removed to make a tight seal? Rural people have good options for getting by. Water is our weak point unless we use a generator, which won't work when there's no gas. Any thoughts on water from a well?
So that is a very real issue for folks who don't live within, in places where they either have city or town-supplied water or have backup generators. So you, I think it ties back to personal preparedness and to having the stockpile, right? And then I also think that they can reach out to their local emergency management official and have them come over and look at the well and see if it's a candidate for a hand pump and what resources are available locally.
All right. Well, joining us now is Ted Koppel. He was the anchor of ABC's Nightline from the program's inception in 1980 until his retirement in 2005. His new book is Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. Ted Koppel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Well, I'm in the studio here with Josh Francis, who's Director of Emergency Preparedness for Maine Medical Center, and John Lamb of the American Red Cross. And we're talking about emergency preparedness. In your book, you make the case that the U.S. is alarmingly vulnerable to a cyber attack that would take down our power grid and, in turn, other infrastructure, and that we're simply not prepared. How is thinking about preparedness for a cyber attack different from, say, a natural disaster?
Well, natural disasters, and if you go on the Red Cross website, for example, you will find that they alert you to any number of different natural disasters and essentially, in each case, recommend that you have a 2 to 3 day supply of food and water, that you have the necessary prescription medicines, that you and your family agree beforehand on a common meeting place in the event that a disaster strikes and you're not all in the same location at the same time. There is reference to having a battery-powered radio and flashlights, but nothing about a disaster that could last weeks or even months. Nothing about a disaster, with the possible exception of an earthquake, that could affect tens of millions of people at the same time. And I think in this day and age, I was just on a panel the other day with General Keith Alexander, who was the former director of the NSA, who said these days businesses and industries and companies fall into two categories, those that have been hacked and those that don't know it. I think it's most likely, and this is not me speaking, it's me reporting what the president has said, what former secretaries of defense, what secretaries of Homeland Security have said. It's not a question of if such an attack will happen. It's only a question of when.
You completed your book, obviously, before the attacks on Beirut and Paris. Do you see these violent attacks as connected to your concerns about cybersecurity?
Absolutely. Terrorism is the kind of response that the weak employ against the strong. When I say the weak, I'm not meaning to show any sympathy whatsoever for ISIS or groups like ISIS. I simply mean these are groups that don't have their own air force. They don't have their own missiles. They don't have their own navy. And so in years past and up to the present, they're still employing things like box cutters on a plane, as they did on 9/11, or in the case of what just happened in Paris, AK-47s and suicide vests. What is that cyber attacks, first of all, do not require that kind of weaponry. They simply require that you have someone extraordinarily skilled in hacking and send a couple of $10 in cash. If they don't have the expertise already, they can probably buy it. And the other dangerous thing about hacking is that it can usually be done, at least in the initial stages, anonymously. So the danger of a counterattack is diminished.
I'm interested in your observation that preparing for the unknown demands balancing prudence with paranoia. As you've immersed yourself in this issue of cyber threat and preparedness, how do you come to that balance personally? And following up, what have you done for your family?
Well, let's take the first part of that first. During the 1960s, for example, we were terribly concerned about the danger of a nuclear missile attack from the Soviet Union. And we took a lot of measures and followed a lot of tactics, if not strategies, that turned out to be probably useless. Whether it was exercises in which we evacuated entire towns and, you know, just for a day, moved them about 40 miles down the road and then brought them back again, whether it was the building of home bomb shelters or the building of shelters in our urban centers, the value of those measures was not only limited, they were probably useless in the sense of practicality. In another sense, they were very helpful, because while we and the Soviets did the same thing, we gradually came to the conclusion that those weren't going to work for us and weren't going to work for them. And ultimately, it led to the policy that has kept us more or less secure from nuclear war over the past 50 or 60 years, namely one of a balance of terror, mutual assured destruction. The knowledge that even after a nuclear attack, either party would still be capable of responding with a horrific counterattack. So what I'm saying here, Jennifer, is it may not be possible for us to plan for precisely what happens, but the act of preparation itself, the act of considering a problem and dealing with the possible ramifications of it, are enormously useful. You ask what I've done. I have bought enough. I've bought enough freeze-dried food to last my children and grandchildren for a couple of months each. My wife and I have a similar kind of supply. Basically, that's not much of a preparation, and you don't have to regard it as a preparation for a cyber attack. It would be just as useful in the case of any other emergency.
All right. John Lamb, Josh Francis, do either of you have a question for Ted Koppel?
Well, I just think from I just want to reiterate what Mr. Koppel was talking about and how reliant we are on our electronic infrastructure and our power grid. And speaking from the medical center's perspective, we rely on computers so much for everything. So we're able to really have folks dedicated to things like this. But I just want to make that point that, you know, we do have people who watch over this, but I do really think that we are vulnerable.
It strikes me, I'm looking at you, Josh Francis, and talking to you, Ted Koppel. I'm sure you have done a lot of reporting, as have I, on the whole movement toward the electronic health record, the portable electronic health record. If there's a cyber attack in which we all lose our health record and we go to a main medical center, it's not very helpful to be relying on our memory, especially if we've fallen and cracked our head on the ice. What do you recommend in that case?
Well, it's very true. You know, at the hospital, we plan and exercise just going back to what we did 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, which was everything was on paper. And that's sort of how we practice and prepare for something like that when the network does go down. And it happens on a regular basis where we lose our network because of infrastructure failure, where we do need to temporarily go to these backup plans. But thankfully, we have really good plans in place to address them.
All right. Well, we do have to go to another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life. And the Clean Bedroom, helping create eco-friendly sleep environments, 477 4th Street in Portland and in Kittery at Dan's Crossing, thecleanbedroom.com.
They'll come right at you. You hold your ground. Don't move.
Don't move? What if they have claws and big teeth?
Don't overthink it.
The new Disney Pixar animated film, The Good Dinosaur, opens in theaters next week. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Peter Sohn. He also worked on The Incredibles, Ratatouille, and WALL-E. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Speaking in Maine. We'll head to Portland and USM for the Frank M. Coffin Lecture on Law and Public Service. The speaker today is Mary Bonato, Civil Rights Project Director at GLAAD. That's Speaking in Maine coming up at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Personal Emergency Preparedness. In the studio with me, John Lamb with the American Red Cross, Josh Francis, Director of Emergency Management at Maine Medical Center, and on the line with us, Ted Koppel. His new book is Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. During the break, Josh and I were talking about how we are having this discussion in the midst of a real changed culture in which now what we're in is a just-in-time culture. Grocery stores don't have big stocks in the back of the stores like they used to. Everything we expect immediately, so we don't stock up as families like we used to. Ted Koppel, it's sort of a really dangerous combination, isn't it, that this really enormous threat at the same time that as a nation we're perhaps becoming less prepared than ever before.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, and it particularly pertains to our urban centers. I spoke, for example, to the head of the Department of Homeland Security for the state of New York, and I said, what would you do in the event that the power went out, not for a few days, but for a few weeks in New York State? And he said, well, we have 25 million MREs, meals ready to eat. And I said, okay, if we just look at the five boroughs of New York alone, that's 8 million people. Forget about the rest of New York State. If you just divvied that up among the 8 million in New York, that would be one meal per person for 3 days. What do you do on day 4, 5, and 6? And he said, then we're going to be in trouble. That is precisely the point. One of the reasons that I focus on freeze-dried food is freeze-dried food has a far longer survivability, 25 to 30 years. The government does not stock massive supplies of MREs. By massive, I mean hundreds of millions of MREs, because they only have a shelf life of 5 years. So investing in that many MREs when you don't know precisely when you're going to need them is just not seen as cost-effective.
We have an email from Norton. He writes, be aware, the source of electrical shutdown can be sunstorms. Major ones happen every 25 years or so. We are past due. Also be aware that you will also lose natural gas and water system. We get these products with the benefit of electric pumps. There will be perhaps a week of fuel for your generators to continue pumping water and natural gas, gasoline for your car. Once the generator backup fuel is gone and we lose the use of toilets, electricity, natural gas, and fuel for the car and food, our food comes by trucks that need to fuel. How to prepare. Ted, this is the whole point of your book, isn't it? Whether it's solar storms or a cyber attack.
No, that's exactly right. Whether it's solar storms, cyber attack, an electromagnetic pulse, or for that matter, as was the case out in Northern California, where some group of people, and this happened a couple of years ago, and the FBI still doesn't know who did it, used AK-47s to shoot out a number of large power transformers. Any one of these things can bring down a section of the grid. And if you have a few million people without electricity for a period of weeks or even months, and I realize that sounds like a ludicrously long period of time, but it could happen, and indeed it's very likely to happen, then what your listener just emailed in is very likely to happen. And the key point there is waste disposal. In a major city, if you can't flush the toilet and waste, human waste begins to back up over a period of a week or two, you have a massive health crisis on your hands.
We're going to go to Nichols, who is calling from Eastport. Hi, Nichols. Go ahead.
Hi. I have some experience in living 6 years off the grid, and solar panel or two will handle the pump for a deep well. That's what I used. And Also, propane refrigerators are extremely efficient and run for a long time and are just as cold as ones that run off electricity. As for the waste problem, a short-term waste problem is, interestingly, Ziploc bags. It's obviously not long-term, but in a crisis, that will work. Any other advice I can give, I'd be glad to do so. A wood stove is always useful. A good supply of wood will help you, obviously. All these things are just thinking ahead.
Ted Koppel, one thing you found in your book is that rural America seems to be a little bit better prepared than the densely populated urban areas.
I'm glad you gave me a chance to respond to it, because that's exactly the point I was going to make. Rural America is not only better prepared, rural America is in a better position to do the kinds of things that your caller was suggesting. The idea of a wood stove doesn't work in an urban apartment. The idea of a generator is less practical in an urban apartment than it is in a rural setting. All of these things, I think, simply underscore the point that I've made, and that is our friends in rural communities, I think, are going to do a lot better than people who live in our great cities.
I'd just add that typically the rural areas are much more resilient as well. You know, they rely on community for a lot of things because they don't have the resources that we have in urban, you know, in urban settings. And I think the culture of the just-in-time culture is not just in our industry, but it's also in it's our generation. It's how we access things. And younger generations are accessing just-in-time food delivery off of sending a text message of an emoji, or they're being able to walk down the street for a meal and not have to worry about the stockpiles because it's at their fingertips. When you look at the rural areas and the older generations, those are the folks who are way better prepared here in Maine, at least.
Someone might listen to Ted Koppel or others who are talking about, you know, our caller who's talking about solar panels and a propane refrigerator, or buying several months worth of freeze-dried foods, and say, you know what, I just can't afford that. What is your recommendation for someone who has a really limited income to try to prepare for themselves, John?
I think you can do it little by little. If you want to stock up on water, for example, maybe every time you go to the grocery store, you buy a gallon. And over the course of weeks, you build up your supply and you do the same thing. You set aside, let's say, a can of tuna fish every week or two, or some non-perishable. And, again, rotate it. So if you normally eat tuna fish, then you just make sure you have X number of cans there. And you make sure that that you eat the most dated.
So little by little. A friend of mine just returned from Europe and said in Switzerland there are groups of people who get together and plan community preparedness together, that this is being taken much more seriously in Europe, and that there may be a group where somebody who has extra room in their home is in charge of the food storage and someone else has, you know, the generator, and we'll all go sleep there. Have any of you, Ted Koppel, or either of you in the studio here with me, heard of movements like that taking hold in the United States?
Well, if I may, I spent three chapters focusing on the Mormons in Lights Out, because the Mormons have a 200-year-long history in this country of having to survive one crisis, one emergency, one disaster after another. And the Mormons recommend, for example, precisely what one of your guests there was suggesting, that people begin on a week-by-week basis to slowly build up their food supplies. And if I may, just one other point. I'm fully aware of the fact that there are many people who can't afford to put a meal on the table every day. It's ludicrous to suggest that they would somehow be able to set aside a 2 or 3 month supply of food. What I am saying, though, is to the degree that those of us who can afford it do it, then if the government is better prepared than it is right now, and the government has supplies which it can bring to bear, those supplies will go a lot further among the people who can't afford to do it for themselves.
And we do have a similar sense of community here in Maine, where neighbors do check on neighbors during power outages. I don't think that they've gone to the extreme of gathering by community to think about who's going to run the generator and who's going to stockpile the food. But what we have seen historically during disasters this year is that communities do take care of each other and people do check on each other.
All right. Joining us now by phone is Gail Rice with Central Maine Power. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
I'm great.
Well, I just wanted to chime in a little bit. You know, we are very aware of the emerging threat, as Lynette Miller called it, to the systems, and we believe protecting the grid is absolutely vital to life, health, and safety for everyone, and we take that responsibility very seriously. We have significant resources devoted to both physical and cybersecurity, and that department has executive leadership, and it's one of our fastest-growing departments. And it's funny that you have this show on today because today is the day of GridX 3, which is a national disaster drill amongst electric grid operators throughout North America. So this is something that we are consistently working on. It is, as Lynette said, it is an emerging threat. And as Mr. Koppel said, the act of preparation itself is enormously useful. So that's what we're working on right now. Devoting a lot of time and energy to that.
Ted Koppel, do you have a question or a thought for Gail Rice? Gail is speaking for the largest electric utility in Maine.
Yes, and the largest utilities are doing an awful lot to prepare to defend themselves against the likelihood of a cyber attack. But as she well knows, and as many of your listeners probably know, the three grids are made up of 3,200 different electric companies around the country. The smaller ones, the ones that don't have a great deal of money, the ones that are investor-owned, have been remarkably reluctant to spend some of their scarce resources on cybersecurity. And the problem with any network, particularly a network that has to be controlled by a SCADA system, I don't want to get too wonky on you, but supervisory control and data acquisition, the system as a whole has to be kept in absolute and perfect balance between the amount of electricity that is generated and the amount of electricity that is used. Without the internet, you can't do that. The internet, I'm afraid, is vulnerable. And if you can get into one of the smaller companies, some of the more skilled hackers, nation states like China and Russia, for example, are able to get into the bigger power companies too.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling, Gail, and for your response, Ted Koppel. I know we just have a little bit of time left, and John Lamb, you want to talk about a new initiative for underway that the American Red Cross is focusing on children.
Yeah, we've talked about preparedness, but we haven't addressed kids as much, and they're a big part of it. We have launched a free program called the Pillowcase Project, and it came from Katrina, where somebody noticed that the college students who were displaced were walking around with their belongings in a pillowcase. So this is a program free, and we'll go to a classroom or a youth group or whatever for kids ages 8 to 11, and the goal is to increase their awareness of potential hazards and help them develop coping skills. While they're there, they'll also get a pillowcase that they can color, and that becomes their go bag. And again, it's a free program. We're working with the Girl Scouts to spread it out, but it's a nice opportunity to get kids involved. And the secondary benefit of that is the kids are going to go home and tell mom and dad, we need to be prepared.
All right. Well, we will post a link to that on our webpage. Thank you all for being here today. Ted Koppel was the first host of the long-running ABC News program Nightline. His new book is Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, and Surviving the Aftermath. Thank you. John Lamb is with the American Red Cross. Josh Francis is Director of Emergency Management at Maine Medical Center. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today, and we had additional technical help from John Keimel. Tomorrow on the program, join Keith Shortall for a conversation about the lottery. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.